you can control almost any other application. At one point in the past, I made a RPA process that followed your keyboard and your mouse. It would happily go through and click things and copy things and move things around just using the keyboard and the mouse. It's not particularly efficient, but it's possible using VBA. So, and that's one of the risks around VBA, because it is so powerful, right? So because it's so powerful, it can do almost anything.
Hello and welcome to Tech for Finance, where we help finance pros stay ahead of the game, develop their skills, and free up time for the things that matter most using technology. Please like and subscribe.
Hey everyone, so today we have the pleasure of welcoming Mark Proctor to the show. Mark is founder at Excel Off the Grid, and he spends his time helping people automate in Excel, if I've got that right, Mark.
That's pretty much it.
There we go. So Mark is a Microsoft MVP. So yeah, he definitely knows what he's talking about. It keeps me on my toes. We'll come back to the comment you made on my LinkedIn post the other day in due course. But no, we met at the Microsoft Global Excel Summit a few months ago. Loved Mark's presentation. You talked through a load of ways that you can automate in Excel, and we'll get into some of the weeds of that today. But I thought we'd kick off just with a question, and I know we touched on this when we last had a catch-up, Mark, about one of the questions that we got from the audience, because a lot of the presentation that you went through, talking through some of the steps in automating process using Excel, relied on VBA.
Yep.
And one of the questions from the audience was, what's your view of Microsoft basically shelving VBA, you know, considering it more like a dated language and that sort of stuff? And the response was, well, it still works and there's still some stuff you can do in VBA that you can't do in other stuff. So I don't know whether you want to talk a little bit more about that, and then maybe we can decipher some of the other type languages that,
yep,
that people might start thinking about as well.
So, I mean, in terms of VBA, so the presentation was primarily around VBA and how we can use that inside a framework. I'm sure we'll talk about that framework more in a while. And we use VBA inside that. And the reason we talk about VBA is primarily that is the application which is available, or the language which is available to everyone inside Excel, whether you're Mac, although you've got some challenges there, or PC, it's there, it's already installed, everyone has it. So, VBA isn't gonna go anywhere anytime soon. Let's make that clear, because, I was it 1995, I think it came out. So we've had almost 30 years of using VBA. The number of applications that have been built on VBA is enormous. And if Microsoft just decided one day, we're going to turn off VBA, there would be the biggest clamor for perpetual licenses that you've ever seen. Excel 2021 would be the most popular perpetual license application there's ever been. And people would abandon Excel or Office 365 because businesses can't risk. In that situation, businesses would be like, well, if you can't have VBA, then we need to find a different solution. So there's so much of the... You know, there's so many financial processes and other areas that still use applications and methods built on VBA. So it's not going anywhere anytime soon. The fact that Microsoft are focusing primarily on cloud technologies, right? That's where they want to go, and that's where they're going to continue to work towards. There's lots of benefits for cloud technologies from their perspective. I mean, I'm sure they love that monthly license subscription, let's face it. And it ensures that people do pay them every month. It gives them one version to maintain. There's lots of advantages. But VBA isn't going away anytime soon because it would just be, in my opinion, maybe they will, who knows? In my opinion, it will be commercial suicide if they were to do anything of the sort. So yeah, it might be an old language, but it is the language that we've got that is available inside every version of Excel. So, you know, the context of where we use it and how we can use it is probably the most important thing. And when we compare it against other languages, you know, someone might say, oh, I prefer Python, I prefer C# or, you know, whatever you want to talk about. you know, and all of that's nice, but none of those are pre-installed with Excel available right there. So, you know, the context of what you're working on is probably the biggest driver, rather than how dated a language is or whether it's how long it's going to last. If it's there in the tool that you're working with, then that's what you're going to use.
And something that you mentioned in our last discussion that I found quite interesting is maybe VBL having a bit of a reemergence off the back of AI. Because, of course, people that didn't previously know how to write stuff in VBA, just ask ChatGPT or the equivalent AI chatbot, you know, how do I write the VBA script for this, right? Yep. So it's almost as if it's found a second life.
I mean, what a perfect, you know, if you want to train AI on something, then you want a language that's been so well documented over thousands, millions of blog posts. People try, you know, giving different ways of covering the same techniques, the different techniques, all using the same types of code over and over again. And you've got, I mean, the fact that you had the internet starting to bloom around, you know, the late 90s, that's when VBA came out. So you've got all that time for ChatGPT and all these large language models to harvest all of that. And therefore, it's kind of, in terms of a tool, how easy is it for ChatGPT to take all of that? And therefore, it's for people who couldn't write VBA before, you know, it's almost like VBA is almost here to stay more because of AI and because it's now, you know, the other day, so I tried ChatGPT out on some Office scripts. So it's built on TypeScript and various other things. And it was something reasonably simple, but it just couldn't do it. It couldn't handle that scenario. And it's because various elements about that language just, it didn't know, it couldn't appreciate, it couldn't give that enough prominence in its large language model to give an answer that is actually correct. I'm sure if I'd have asked the same thing in VBA, it would have done it instantly. And maybe first time, I might have to have questioned it again, but it would have got there. And that's because there's so much that it has been trained on. When other newer languages that are emerging, there's less stuff there. So it becomes harder for people using ChatGPT to then, or other AIs to then use these languages without some level of actual knowledge.
And I think as well, it is also an easier entry point than some of these other sort of, in quote, more complex languages, because obviously everybody says if you're going to learn code, then obviously Python is one of the easiest entry points because it's technically one of the simplest to get to terms with. I mean, you mentioned another one like C#, and you know, all of those other languages that I profess to not understand at all. But I've been having some conversations recently because, of course, with the advent of AI, it does make it a lot easier for you to generate code. And, of course, you saw the presentation from Leila Gharani at the Excel event as well, where she tried to ask ChatGPT to basically create some sort of machine learning algorithm that would help her identify what feedback from her courses was actionable and what wasn't. And she struggled. You know, just AI alone wouldn't cut the mustard, right? And I'm seeing more of that becoming an issue with lack of experience and lack of base knowledge, because a lot of people will go to Python to think, oh, now I've got AI to write Python for me, I can do all of this clever statistical stuff that I've not done before. Some of them do it without a base understanding of the way that the data is put together, thinking that, oh, if I've got a bit of code, then you know, it will solve the problems for me. And sometimes it does, depending on what it feels like on that day. And that's the thing that we need to not forget, right? It's generative. The response it gives every time is always going to be different. You know, there's not really anything consistent around large language models, unless you're a prompt engineer or whatever you profess to be. But where I'm going with that is, not everybody can just get AI to generate a bit of Python code, have it talk to your data, and then produce all of these perfect visualizations straight away. There's still a learning curve. And even myself, who maybe is slightly more technical than some of the other people I know, I've still struggled to get the results that I'd expect just by Q&A-ing a large language model using something like Python. But something like VBA, as you say, you've already got it available. There's less complexity. Well, I think there's less complexity. I'm not a VBA pro by any sense. I mean, you can fill in the gaps there. But as you say, it's already built in. So you've not got to go to your IT team, to your point when we spoke last, to request like installing Python and Visual Studio Code and all this sort of stuff on your machine. It's there and ready to go, right?
Yeah, and some of those things that are around how we deal with kind of how we query that large language model is that even if you have a language which is better. So let me think about Python, for example. So you can, in Python started at roughly the same time as VBA, I believe. It's just the fact that people have generated, you know, libraries that have then extended that even further. And even if ChatGPT can write a piece of Python code, unless someone understands the structure and stuff, like how, especially from an Excel user perspective, because often a spreadsheet is it's a two-dimensional thing, right? You have rows and you have columns, where normally a database or something similar is really a one-dimensional thing. It has, the data goes down. So often people start with the incorrect data structures to start with. They don't actually understand how to structure data in the right way. So even if you query a large language model on how to do something in Python or somewhere else, if you haven't got the right structure, what it will give you, even if the code is correct, right? The code might be perfect, but if you've not structured things the right way, it's not going to drive the result that you want. So the thing that always beats artificial intelligence is actual intelligence, right? Because you're laughing now. Because ultimately, if we know how to do something, we don't have to use artificial intelligence. If we know how to structure a database correctly, if we know how to build out our process correctly, then the AI, that serves almost no purpose. It's plugging the gaps in the fact that we don't understand things. For people that understand what they're doing, they'll set things up the right way. They'll get their data in the right place. They'll work in the right way. They've got their data in the perfect layout, which means that when it comes to getting a piece of Python code, that code is almost the easiest bit that needs to be done because everything is already structured the right way. And good structure beats everything else. Okay, when you've got good structure, your data cleaning and all that suddenly becomes, it's a walk in the park, right? Because everything's already in the right place. So if we could get those elements right around how we structure things, how we structure solutions, our use of ChatGPT is no longer just about throwing out prompts into the world in the hope that one of them might pay off. But actually, we'll be taking something that works, something we know is in the right format, and then ChatGPT is really just giving us a few lines of code that then helps us to do what we need to do. Because most of the time, if we structure things the right way, the complexity is actually reasonably low. It's when we don't structure things the right way that the complexity then increases. And often it's the exceptions, right? You must know this working in your field as well, that if there's no exceptions to the rule, everything is simple. But as soon as it's the case of, everyone receives this report, okay? That's straightforward. Everyone receives this report. Everyone receives this report apart from Dave on a Wednesday. Suddenly it's like that then has to change. And then it's like, well, Dave receives these 7 pages, but not these 6 pages. But on Friday he gets this, but doesn't get that. And you build up all these other exceptions. You've got, exceptions with, the CEO's brother-in-law happens to be a supplier and we have to pay him exactly on time or else his brother-in-law complains. Well, hopefully we should pay everyone on time anyway, but he's got shorter payment terms than everyone else and his invoice never comes in on time and we make exceptions for him, exceptions for these people. And suddenly the complexity starts to increase and that's where a lot of the junk comes from. But if we could get to the point of structure, then actually the amount of code we need and whatever we need to do is reasonably straightforward.
And I want to emphasize what you said there, and whether it's Python, VBA, or whatever the automation piece is, the actual mechanics around that, as you say, are the last piece of the puzzle.
Yep.
Yeah. And I wanted to emphasize that because it comes back to that planning and structural piece. And it's, you know, it's the cheesy quote, isn't it? You know, give me a problem to solve and I'll spend the first 50, like, give me a problem to solve in an hour and I'll spend the first 55 minutes thinking about it. And then the last 5 minutes actually, you know, doing the work, right? Same story as, you know, the offshore oil engineer that costs, you know, $5,000 an hour, you know, and they turn up and they spend an hour looking around, they get the little hammer out, bash in a certain place and everything's fixed. And they're like, $5,000 just to bash on a little hammer. Yeah, but you pay me for the knowing where to bang. Do you know what I mean? It's the same principle, isn't it? And I found when I've worked with developers in the past, and this is why one of the posts or part one of the posts that I did recently mentioned a good idea is to try and think like a developer. It's not always easy to do, but if you ever speak to a developer, and I would encourage everybody listening to at least try and seek out a conversation with the developer, because you'll see the perspective, you'll see a very different world. But if you ask a developer to solve a problem, they'll quite often come back and say, well, why are you solving for that problem? Yeah. Or I know, I think you're thinking about this the wrong way. You know, have you thought about doing this? Or I think actually a better, more elegant or more simple way of doing it is this. And it's because they're always looking for the path of least resistance and the most scalable solution. Yep. You know, some people look at that and think, oh, well, you're just trying to find a way to do something with the least amount of effort, right? You know, but in reality, it's all with the greater good in mind. Do you know what I mean? So there's an argument to say that if something has become complicated, you're solving for the wrong problem, or there's a process change that needs to happen rather than a complex, you know, automation thing that needs to happen. I don't know whether you'd agree.
Yeah, if you've got something that's complex, if it's in terms of the process, then chances are there are too many exceptions. You're trying to use that process for too many things, and therefore that adds the complexity. Or from a developer's perspective, you know, you've got, you know, going back to that previous example about Dave received this unless it's a Wednesday. You know, you go to the developer and say, this is what I want. Dave receives this unless it's a Wednesday. And he'll be like, hang on, why Dave? Why a Wednesday? Because ultimately, if you say it's always Dave and it's always a Wednesday, there's a good chance that's going to be hard coded somewhere. And suddenly to unpick that at a later date becomes a nightmare. When really your developer will be like, okay, I want to understand the parameters and what's in that list and why those things get excluded. Today it's Dave. Maybe it could be Mandy on a Thursday, another day. So we need to build in that, all those elements into that process rather than just going, bang, here's exactly what you asked for. Because if they give us exactly what we asked for, we'll soon end up with a whole load of technical debt. And the next time we go, oh, it's now Mandy on a Thursday as well, they were like, well, it's going to be 3 months before we get around to that. When otherwise, if they have built it correctly the first time, Mandy on a Thursday is no problem. That just goes onto some other list and gets sorted out. But the perspective of the rules that we want, definitely the developers are trying to help us to make sure that we can handle that complexity, but ultimately we want to try and avoid that complexity entirely by having consistency in how we work.
100%. And I'll use one other very simple example of how something that was meant to be a very simple piece of code became incredibly complicated because of one variable. So the aim was quite simple, and it was using Python, because I quite like doing the, you know, use an AI to create a bit of code. You feel quite powerful if you, you know, run a bit of code and it outputs something. You're like, oh, hooray, it worked. You know, I didn't think that would actually work, and it does. But the theory was, I've got an Excel data set from a supplier that has rubbish data in it. Not rubbish, but very poorly formatted data. Yep. And some of the stuff is easy, you know. So for my internal records, I need to take this data, I need to reformat that data, and I need to delete that data. So the premise is very simple. So you might have stuff like, you know, if you're obsessive compulsive like me, capitalization on all of your letters, you know, that's easy to do. Stuff like job titles, for example, you know, or first name and second name, so that you don't have all caps or all lowercase or all whatever, if you're wanting to keep your data clean. Very easy to add in additional columns with a bit of code. Yeah, so I need to add in this column with this data across all of the rows, just so that I can build that into my reporting and do extra analysis with the extra data that we need for our reporting. But then there's a column with a number. In this instance, it was a phone number. And in all of those numbers, there was a combination of 07 or 01 numbers. There was plus 44 numbers. There were numbers with gaps in them. There were numbers that were missing the leading zeros. So I tried to train it to say, look, you know, here's your data structure. Here's your column headings. Here's what happens in all of the rows. So this is how to interpret the data and the formatting in the rubbish example. And this is what I want you to output in the good examples. And just for that one piece that would take those rubbish phone numbers and make sure that they were all plus 44.7 or plus 44.1 or whatever it would happen to be, consumed about 50% of the code because of the number of variables and the gaps and the way that it was displayed. And it took me 5 or 6 different iterations to get that right, you know, from somebody who was semi-experienced at generating that sort of code. But whereas if I'd said instead, either, well, phone numbers aren't that important, I'm not going to import them, that would have been the part, that would have been part of least resistance, right? But if I'd said, when the supplier sends through the data, it needs to be in this format. And maybe that's a more difficult argument because the supplier probably isn't going to change their data format, right? But you hear what I'm saying, that there is always an alternative that says, right, well, instead of us having to solve for this problem that's producing something really complicated that doesn't scale, how do we cut that off before it becomes a problem to solve?
Yep.
And I think that's kind of similar to what you've just been saying there.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got data issues, then let's cut them off at source rather than letting them continue and then fixing them later. Because equally, even once you've fixed all those telephone numbers, how do you know that one of those numbers that started with an 07 wasn't a Norwegian number and it wasn't a plus 44, it was something else? You don't actually know because you haven't actually got enough data about that number to know whether it's right or wrong. Even when you're performing those kind of actions, you're always taking a bit of a punt at the end of the day, because you're not, unless you go to phone that phone number, in which case, you know, let's say there's supplier information, somebody goes to phone that supplier and the number goes to the wrong person, at that point, you know it's wrong. But until that point, because your data isn't in a clean enough state, then even once you've cleaned it, you are still taking a guess as to filling in those gaps. And that's just the way it is when your data isn't, you haven't collected the right data to start with. And as soon as that's flagged up, it should be a case of, right, we need to fix that at source, make sure that we collect that right information. And, you know, each time you get a new supplier, if it's not in the right format, somebody, whether it's somebody in your team or whether you go back to that supplier, somebody needs to go, how should this be? Let's get this right.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. And the next pain that I didn't mention was it actually, when it came to testing it, because the whole premise was that I could engineer myself out of that equation. So I put a little user interface on it, created it as an app so that anybody could run it without having to need to run Python on their machine. So that was quite good. Didn't mention the fact that the IT team came back saying, oh, what's this unauthorized app that somebody's running? But either way, they let them run them in the end. But the mistake I made is that particular Python library would only work on a workbook, not on a CSV, and the data was in a CSV. So I had to engineer it, and this was the last bit of the code, as opposed to what I should have probably done at the beginning, to convert the CSV into an Excel workbook so it could actually run the remainder of the code, because otherwise it just errored and says, sorry, I can't run this app because the data's in the wrong format. But what I didn't know is that the raw data, because of the formatting and the base data, it had truncated some of the numbers, not all of them. But basically, because it was a large digit, it had said, right, it did that funny thing of where it does like plus 44 point whatever, you know, and it tries to basically condense the number down into a decimal. I don't know the logic behind it. But either way, the code ran exactly as it should have done. But what it did, because the number was truncated, is it got the first four digits right, but then it just added a string of zeros.
Yeah. So if you've got, yeah, so I think Excel's got, I think it works to 15 significant digits. But okay. This is interesting. So some functions work to 17 significant digits, some work to 15. So once you get into, you can end up with some very small rounding differences. That if you're doing a lookup on a decimal or a floating point number, you can end up with some errors coming through into Excel just because of how point one is handled in binary and all of those pieces. So, you know, even once you've got stuff in the right format, there are technical issues around binary and everything else that is more than happy to trip you up. But yeah, phone numbers, credit card numbers, anything that, if you've got a CSV and you put it into Excel, Excel's going to go, oh, fantastic, a number. And it'll then apply its 15 digits, I think it's 15. And then suddenly whatever number you've got ends in zeros and it's not the number you thought it was to start with.
Yeah, it just ends up as gibberish. Yeah. So, word of warning to anybody that's just trying to magically solve stuff by getting AI to produce code, I guess. But if we try and get the conversation back to what's potentially going to be less nerdy and more useful for the listeners. So talking about VBA then, some people have probably got some sort of base knowledge on the premise of VBA and what you can do with it. From your perspective, working in the land of automation, what are some of the things that people can do with VBA that they might not immediately think are possible, that you think are potentially low-hanging fruit or quick wins that they can start building into their workflow?
I suppose there's an element of actually flipping that question on its head also as to what do people do with VBA that they no longer need to do?
Okay.
Because there's an element of whenever anyone goes on a VBA course, the things that people tend to look at to start with are how do you deal with workbooks, how do you deal with worksheets, how do you deal with ranges? And often they teach people how to move data between workbooks and various other things. And in all honesty, we've got other tools in Excel. So Power Query now is that's the method by which we move things between workbooks. If you're using VBA or move data between workbooks, if you're using VBA, it's you're almost working too hard. You're writing a whole load of code that you don't need to write. In our training programs, we talk about the refresh, resize, and recalc cycle, which effectively is like using Power Query, you refresh, that will then connect to your data source, that then creates a table that then resizes so it can expand or retract depending on how many rows of data you've got, which then feeds your formula, and then your formula then recalcs. You've got this refresh, resize, and recalc cycle, and that will cover, in terms of automation, 80% of what you ever need to do in Excel, because you can go straight from going data refresh all, and it'll take you all the way through, here's your end dashboard or report or whatever you need to do. You've written no code whatsoever. You just used the tools that are already there. Mm-hmm. So in terms of VBA, that really leaves VBA at kind of the extremes of that process. So in the middle of the process, you've got this refresh, resize, and recalc. At the extremes, you've got, okay, well, how do we get data into the right place so that we can easily use it? So think about how do we make sure that we enforce naming conventions and make sure that files are saved in the right place. So in our training program, we have a tool that helps you maintain your file naming conventions so that you always know that your trial balance report, whatever it happens to be, is always saved in the same place, in the same, or depending on your month and your year, it's saved in the same relative path for your right month and year, et cetera, et cetera. You've then got this other automation bit. And then once you get to the end, you're then using VBA in terms of how do you then work with the output of your report. So how do you distribute that to people? How do you create your PowerPoint presentations, refresh your PowerPoint presentations? I worked in a business where we had, I think the biggest we had was 376 pages of a PowerPoint presentation, which when someone says, I've changed a couple of numbers, would you mind updating that presentation for me? It was like, it's that, that's the moment that you cry, okay? Unless, of course, you'd be like, so right, because I've got all of this automated, right? Everything is going to update and flow through automatically. And actually what should take an entire day, admittedly, it still takes Excel quite a while. You click refresh and then you just walk off, make yourself a cup of coffee, come back in a while and see whether it's completed. So, but VBA, because it's got reference libraries, so you can do, much like you can with Python, so Python has reference libraries and VBA has reference libraries. So depending on what applications you've got installed, one of the more common ones is if you've got Adobe, so full Adobe, not just the Acrobat Reader, but the full Adobe, you can merge PDFs and you can split PDFs and you can do anything, almost anything you like PDFs, because there's a library that you can reference using VBA. And there's lots of other applications. You can control Word, you can control OneNote, you can control Outlook. All of that is possible with VBA because there's all those libraries there, and it's just a matter of working out what those libraries are and how you use them. And that's where often the documentation isn't as good as it could be, because it's quite a specific piece of VBA code. But you can control almost any other application. At one point in the past, I made an RPA process that followed your keyboard and your mouse, and you could literally, if all your apps stayed exactly the same, it would happily go through and click things and copy things and move things around just using the keyboard and the mouse. It's not particularly efficient, but it's possible using VBA. So, and that's one of the risks around VBA, because it is so powerful, right? So because it's so powerful, it can do almost anything. And that's where one of the biggest risks are. And that's one of the reasons why, Microsoft are not so keen on it being an application that they want to continue to promote, because, over time, security becomes a bigger and bigger concern.
And with my cynical hat on, and I don't have many cynical hats, I'm generally a, glass half full, positive, happy chappy, right? But
I've pushed you too far today, then, obviously.
You've pushed me too far.
That cynical hat has come on.
No, it relates to, obviously, revenue from a Microsoft perspective. Because the more you're running locally, the less you are using their cloud-hosted applications. So you're not driving Azure adoption if you're running applications locally on your machine, right? And I appreciate, if it's Microsoft 365, then, you're running desktop versions and it's synced to the cloud, right? Because obviously you can still use Copilot and all that gubbins in the desktop applications. But, maybe, and you can talk through some of the stuff here, because you mentioned Office Script, right? I'm assuming, and you'll have to bring me up to speed, that it's more focused on being able to run cloud apps than it is local install to be able to do some of the stuff that you mentioned there in terms of RPA and controlling mice and keyboards and that sort of stuff. So I don't know whether you can do a quick, VBA versus Office Script.
It's a difficult one, because they're almost separate use cases. And that's where a lot of the confusion comes from around VBA and Office Scripts, because Microsoft, it's around 2010, I think, possibly 2010, Microsoft said that they weren't going to update the Visual Basic Editor anymore. That's also the same time that they then went and started looking at JavaScript. So that's when they brought out Office.js as their new developers platform, as it were. But you then in around 2020, I think it was, they brought out Office Scripts, and people are like, this must be the thing that's going to replace VBA, because it's a scripting language. We can control what happens inside Excel, et cetera, et cetera. But because it is predominantly cloud-based, although it runs locally, you can run, if you have a file that is saved in your downloads folder, you open it up and you click run to run an Office Script in there, it will go to your OneDrive library, which is saved on the cloud, get that script and then run it locally. But you do always need internet access to be able to run and find that script. So what they want, with Office Scripts, what Microsoft wants to do is, whether you're using Mac, PC, or online, they want you to be able to run the same script, across all those platforms. So that does mean that at the moment, everything you can do in Office Scripts has to work in Excel Online. Now, because that's the most, in terms of feature set, that's the tool that's the furthest behind. So that's an element that that gives us, that kind of makes it harder to use Office Scripts. But also, if you think about what how Office Scripts work and how Excel Online works, and it has this entire piece about collaboration, suddenly once we're working in a collaborative world and people are sharing workbooks amongst each other, some of the things we might do with VBA, we definitely don't want to do in Office Scripts. So for example, with VBA, you could have built an application, and that application might be that as soon as you open up that workbook, it's going to hide all the worksheets apart from the one that you want to work on. And then as you click through various stages of your workbook, it almost creates a wizard as you work through. And that means that you're kind of, you're working in an application, but only you're the one interacting with it. But as soon as you have workbooks that are shared and collaborative, if I'm viewing a workbook and you're viewing a workbook and I come in and the script automatically makes it run like an application, that means that for everyone, it's going to hide all those sheets, put everyone back on the first sheet, and that's not going to work. So how we think about VBA and how it used to work is very much in a standalone Excel application. Office Scripts is very much about how do we automate across in a collaborative space. So we need to think about Office Scripts more in line with how we work with Power Automate in a cloud environment. And I think Office Scripts is more about interacting with Power Automate and how we can use Excel in that Power Automate world rather than Office Scripts replacing VBA. Because of this collaboration piece, we're suddenly working in an entirely different environment. And I think it's the environment that drives how we use these technologies rather than the language. So when people talk about the difference between VBA and Office Scripts, and they say, but Office Scripts don't have events, Office Scripts don't have this, Office Scripts don't have these things. Like, if we did have those things, suddenly you wouldn't be able to use that workbook in a collaborative way. So whether those things will come, I don't know. But how we handle those scenarios means that the technologies can't operate in the same way, which means that they're not really equivalent to each other. Ultimately, people just see, I have the ability to write code to automate Excel. Therefore, Office Scripts and VBA must be the same. But that's not the case at all, because the environments, what they do, how they operate, is quite different. So that's a rather long way of trying to describe the differences between VBA and Office Scripts. But the Office Scripts is always intended to work in a cloud environment that also works on PC and on Mac. And that's going to be the driving force. Well, VBA was developed when we had standalone PCs. And everybody worked on their own PC one at a time. If two people tried to open up the same workbook, it'd be no chance. You know, one person in the workbook at a time. But now that collaborative piece has changed that landscape of how Excel works completely.
And forgive me if I'm oversimplifying this, and treat me as a dummy for a second, because with some of the stuff I still really am familiar with Power Automate. Obviously, I've used it. Low-code/no-code automation, big fan. Yeah. I think anybody that can build it, even if it's a personal use case to automate some of the repetitive stuff they do, I think they should go ahead and at least experiment with some simple workflows. But from what it sounds like you've just explained there, whether it's VBA or Office Script, it's very much a language that's built into the application and revolves around the usage of that application. Whereas Power Automate is more if this, then that, connecting the workflow outside of the application. Am I oversimplifying that?
So Office Scripts is entirely inside your workbook. So you can only operate inside a single workbook. So with VBA, I said you can work with Word and PowerPoint and Adobe and a whole load of other stuff. With Office Scripts, you can work inside your workbook. That's it. That is the scope that you've got. So you've got Power Automate is kind of the vehicle that sits across all of your applications. And one of those applications is Excel. So therefore you can then integrate Excel into your processes using Office Scripts. There are some connects already. You can, I think, create a table, add a row to a table. There's probably 15 or 20 pre-existing connectors that just do one thing. Between Power Automate and Excel. Office Scripts gives you the ability to do anything else. So if you wanted to, you could have an Office Script that, as part of your Power Automate flow, it creates a chart and it has specific data labels and it does something every single time. So that's where we need to think about Office Scripts in terms of this overall piece. So rather than thinking about it as it's in Excel, we need to think about it's about how Power Automate exists across all applications, and it's a way to get Excel to do more. They could have written 2,000 connectors, right? That do one individual thing in Excel, and we're currently calling backwards and forwards to Power Automate, which would be ridiculous, right? So instead, they've said, here's a language in Power Automate. You call your script, and your script then runs and performs whatever action it needs to.
And I think if you live within the Microsoft ecosystem, which of course many businesses do, then in my view, being able to work an Office script into a Power Automate workflow is a lot easier than trying to build in building Python code into a Power Automate workflow, for example. I know you can do it, but it's not an easy job trying to trigger a Python script in a Power Automate workflow, whereas Office script is obviously designed to live within Yes. that ecosystem of applications that you can sit together, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's all... Okay. It is one piece in Microsoft's Power Platform 365 offering. And so therefore it's specifically designed to operate in that environment. When if you're trying to run Python or something else, it was Microsoft haven't designed any of those things to specifically work in that environment. So they've tried to make it as easy as possible for people to do those things in their platform.
Really quick, guys, as you know, I don't run ads and I no longer sell anything on here. So to help me, it'd be great if you could share with just one other person, leave a review, give a thumbs up and subscribe. It really does make a difference. Now back to the show.
Of course. Yeah. I have. all good. So the thing that I was just going to come back to for a second is, and it relates to that LinkedIn post that you jumped on that I mentioned a bit earlier, because I think the theme of the post was five ways that you can extract data from an ERP system or something along those lines. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I mentioned VBA and Python in there. And then one of your comments says, you've forgotten about Power Query. You can't forget about Power Query. Like that would do everything with bells on, right? Which I wholeheartedly agree. My fault. I should have included it in there. But of course, to non-Microsoft users, it's not something that maybe they've come to terms with, or maybe people that aren't just familiar with Power Query can't come to terms with. But for the audience that maybe isn't up to speed with the sort of stuff that you can do with Power Query, you gave the example there in using it for the original source data from a structural perspective before you then go into the automation stages. So are we saying Power Query is more of a data management import tool rather than, can you explain a little bit what you think some of the use cases Power Query are?
So Power Query sits as a category of tool. I believe it gets referred to as an ETL tool, so extract, transform, and load. So that's the place where it sits. And Power Query exists within Excel, it exists within Power BI. Microsoft got some things called data flows, it exists in some form. Power Query exists in Power Automate itself. So it's a tool which, wherever your source data is, whatever your input is, it takes that, it transforms it into whatever shape you need it to be, and then loads it into whatever destination you need it to be. So in terms of structure, it's probably it is the most important tool that we have inside Excel. There's the, I think it was 2016, there was a Forbes article about data scientists, and everyone quotes this stat, so I will as well. About the fact that data scientists spend around 80% of their time preparing and managing data for analysis. So they spend a large majority of their time not actually performing all the algorithms and all the advanced analysis, but just trying to get the data into the right shape so that they can then use it. And that's where Power Query comes in. And even from a finance perspective, you've got trial balances, you've got budgets, you've got your stock report, whatever it happens to be. And you think about those different data sources, and they've all got data that's laid out in slightly different ways. So your trial balance goes, you know, hopefully down. It's got a debit and a credit column and all those things. Chances are your budget has probably got your dates that go across the top, because that's how people forecast dates. So your budget isn't in a first normal form layout. It's, you know, if you're going to work with that in a useful way, you need to reshape that so that it has the right shape to be able to work with formulas easily. So Power Query, in terms of how we work with Excel and work with structures, gets us from here's some input, whatever it happens to be, and it reshapes it, or it leaves stuff out, it performs additional calculations if we need to, and then gets it into the perfect layout so that we can then use it for whatever we need it to do. So one of the things that often, if we think about Excel, we often think about formulas, and formulas are, you know, that's the thing that most people think about, right? Excel, we've got cells, and we have formulas. But what people often then get caught up on the complexity of a formula, how difficult a formula needs to be. And the reason that we end up with such complex formulas is often, much like we mentioned earlier about Python and how if you get the structure right, your code ends up being easy. If you get the structure right, your formulas end up being easy. But people don't get the structure right, therefore they have to write very complex formulas to handle poor data structures. So what Power Query does is that it gets into that ideal structure so that we don't have to write complex formulas. And there was a study done in 2020 of Power Query users, and they estimated how much time they saved by using Power Query. I don't know what population this was or who was involved in that. It was quite a general survey, I believe. And the response to that survey said they save between 22 and 89 working days per year just by the fact that they could get their data into the right shape before they use it. So between 22 and 89 working days per year, with an average across all those people of 76 days. So that's about 30% of working time is saved by automating our work with Power Query, which basically just takes our input and gets it into the shape that we want so that we can then work with it. So it takes away all that complexity. The number of times, you know, on a finance process, somebody will, you see procedure notes and they're like 15 pages long. And it's a case of, oh, you take this, you copy and paste, you add a column, you delete this column, you remove the total, you move the blank rows, you put it into a pivot table, you do whatever you need to, you copy and paste that over across into a different place, you turn out, you find out you didn't put the field in you need to, you go back to your pivot table, you add a new column, you refresh your pivot table, you copy and paste that somewhere else. And that's the kind of processes that people go through. And Power Query just handles all of that and says, right, here's my source. I click data, refresh all, and it gets you to exactly what you want. So in terms of automation, that is the key piece. That is the biggest tool that we've ever had in Excel for finance people.
And what's the learning curve like for people that have never touched it?
It depends. It depends on what data you're trying to use, right? So if it's as simple as you've got pivoted data, so you've got let's say you've got months across the top and you've got a category down the left, and then you've got all of your data in the middle. If you just want to unpivot that, so you get your column of whatever your thing is, your column of dates, and then a column of values, you know, that's reasonably straightforward. There's a few clicks. If you want to combine all the workbooks together in a folder, so let's say you've got all your cost center reports that have come in and you want to combine all of those together, again, it's a few clicks, assuming that your data is in a reasonable state. It's when you get to the really messy layouts where I had one the other day where, down the page, so they had a row that was like, they had a row of data, or I suppose dimensions is probably a better way to describe it. And then some rows below that, it then had some more granular data that related to all of the rows above, but they were placed above and below each other. So it became, and you had this, like, you'd have like your dimension row, then your more then your actual data, dimension row, data, dimension row, and it went down the page. But you need to get all of that stacked on top of each other into a clean format. And that one was quite tricky. So it depends what kind of data you're dealing with as to the learning curve on it. There's a lot you can do without doing much. But once you get into those trickier formats, then it becomes difficult. I'm of the belief that everything is possible with Power Query in terms of cleaning data. But once you get into those really, really difficult scenarios, you do end up having to write code. There's a language in the background called M-code. And there's 700 functions that are all about how we translate and transform data. And in our membership, in our courses, we have a functions library. So therefore, some of these more advanced transformations, we've created functions that people can just insert into their workbook and use them for harder scenarios. But there's always going to be a case where there's the most bizarre layout you've ever seen because somebody, when they designed a report, thought it was a good idea. And also, let's not forget that sometimes people design things for other purposes. We then want to use them for something else. So therefore, our ability to transform those and translate them is we're trying to use it for something else. So there is a learning curve. It is some things are straightforward. Some things take a bit more skill.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, going back to the point earlier, I mean, that example there you gave of the dimensional layout where you had to unpick, you know, not just the rows and columns, but then obviously the structure within those different bandings within the different dimensions. Obviously, the path of least resistance, as we discussed, would be to go back and say, can I have the report in a different format, please? This is rubbish. But if it's hard-coded into an ERP system, there just might not be a way to change the output format. That data just might not be possible. Or it might be possible, but it might cost you thousands of pounds of development resource to get it restructured. And so,
In an ideal world, so Power Query can connect to lots of different data sources. So in an ideal world, we would be able to connect straight to our ERP and get the data out. But the as you know from a finance perspective, the complexity of finance systems, often they're not built around reporting. They're built around the fact that it has to store data in an efficient way. And often use the example of goods received, not invoiced. Yeah, so you get a report out of goods received, not invoiced from your ERP system, and it all looks nice. Oh, we need to interrogate this. We need to get to the data. But you've got years and years of transactions. That's almost like a rolling thing of constantly tracking invoices and what's been good received and all of those elements. If you tried to get to that data using Power Query and you went, oh, well, I'm going to click refresh on this, you know, you need a huge amount of skill to handle that data of how it's structured inside that ERP system. Because the ERP system is built to work as an ERP system, and those tables are designed in that way. So even if we can get to the data using Power Query, sometimes it's actually better to work with some form of output from that system because there's so much complexity in trying to change a database structure that for holding data into something that we can then use inside Excel.
So how are you doing for time, by the way?
I'm happy to keep going.
Okay, cool. So we've used Power Query to get data in the format that we want. We're then potentially automating that further by using VBA, and you've given a couple of examples, you know, we're going to, you know, trigger the generation or an update of a PowerPoint doc, or we're going to merge some PDFs, or we're going to, you know, do some of those use cases. The next piece is how it scales. Unless it's just an ad hoc use case for yourself, and there's nothing wrong with that either. I do that. You know, I develop automations that will never be shared, but it saves me a few minutes here and there. But coming back to the presentation that you gave at the Excel Summit, you talked through the Unix framework?
The Unix philosophy, yes.
The Unix philosophy. There we go. You know, which I believe was on the premise you know, if you are going to build automations, you want to have a philosophy in place that ensures that you're building in the right way so that they scale. So I don't know whether you can, in the remaining time for the next 5 minutes or so, just walk through that to tell people what the philosophy is.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a story behind this. So I worked in what was effectively an FP&A role, and I used to build these. At the time, I was getting to grips with VBA, and I used to build these. I mean, it's a huge amount of code to deal with a lot of stuff. And you'd work out that, hang on, I'm using this piece of code, and the number of times I'd copy, oh, I want this piece of code, but I went over here, I need to insert it there. And eventually you go, well, how many different actions am I actually performing? How many different things do I actually need to do? And when it's like, oh, you know, because we used to have to deal with a lot of kind of publishing things out as PDFs. How many ways do I need to publish things out as a PDF? Well, I only need one way of doing that. How many ways do I need of automating opening a workbook update or opening a workbook? I only need one way to do that. How many ways do I need to, you know, update a sale value? Well, I only need one way to do that. So in my mind, I came up with this idea of, well, rather than building these long automations that have a lot of code, why don't we build it so it's one piece that then calls these individual steps that do what they need to do. So that's effectively what I built out. It was this, you know, if I wanted to save a PDF, I would call the same piece of code for saving a PDF, and you'd build out these processes that are really just based on lists. So you've got a list of the actions that you want to take. And I was on a call with someone called Charlie Young, who runs engineerexcel.com, and I explained this to him about this, how I was doing this stuff with VBA. And he just said to me, it sounds like the Unix philosophy to me. Now, interestingly, he denies that he's, I've spoken to him since. He said, like, I don't even know the Unix philosophy. I've never even heard of it. I was like, you definitely said that, because I remember sitting there going, oh, Charlie, that's really wise. Oh, Charlie, that is a really sound point. And then straight after that call, going having to Google what it was, because I had no idea. So effectively boils down to these three principles. Now, the Unix was an operating system, I think, that was developed in the late 60s, early 70s. But it's based on these three principles. So that we want to design programs that do one thing and do it well. We want to design programs that work together. And we want to design programs that work with text streams. So as in, you pass text to and from each step in your process. So you've got lots of small applications that do one thing. They all are designed to work together, but they all just pass text to and from each other. And the idea is that text is a universal interface that any application can use. And that's the kind of the framework that I then built out, and then we kind of continue to develop that over time. And what that gives us is the ability to think about automation more like building Lego. So, you know, if we want to open up an Excel workbook, we want to refresh our Power Query, then we want to save the result of that out as a CSV file. We can do that. If we want to open Excel workbook, we want to refresh Power Query, that will then update our reports, and then we update our PowerPoint, which we then save as a PDF and send to somebody. We can do that. It's just about taking these bricks, these individual processes, and then putting them together. And it turns out you don't need as many steps as you think you need, because you just, as long as we have this simple piece in the middle about this, the refresh, resize, and recalc cycle, everything outside of that, you don't actually need as many automations as you think you do. It's only when you work inside Excel and you're working with ranges and charts and all these other elements, you go, well, we don't actually need to automate any of that, because from a process perspective, we can let Excel handle that by itself. Because if you think about automation, there's the automation of the process and then automating how we build a process. So if we're trying to build a process, we might have, let's say our report includes 100 charts. Okay, we don't want to build 100 charts, so we might build out a VBA process to help us build those 100 charts. That's not part of our process, that's about how we build our process. But once we've built that process, how we run it, the number of actions that we need is reasonably limited, because it's always the same kind of things. So that's kind of how the Unix philosophy works, is that, and actually if you think about Power Automate, That is built on a very similar principle, that you've got this Power Automate is the vehicle that drives everything, and it calls to and from all these individual connectors. So I think that a lot of programs are actually built on this same premise. And all it is, well, how do we bring that thinking? And this was something that occurred to me. I haven't ripped off Power Automate, I promise. So this was like 2015, and I was like, why? And literally, I put it nowhere, because I was like, if I share this with people, they're going to think like, he's an idiot. He knows nothing about VBA, because he's trying to tell us that we should have these individual steps that do stuff. And then Power Automate came out, and I was like, I knew I was onto something. because it's a framework about how we think about solving that problem. You could build a Python solution that does exactly the same thing and built on that same framework. Anything that you can do to call other things, you can work in that same way. So the Unix philosophy is something you could use with Python, you can use it with VBA, anything that you can do to call other tools, and then you can, because you're using text to call things, it just flows. And people might say, oh yeah, but something's a number, or this is a number, or this is an object. Yeah, but you pass across your text string that then refers to that object. It's that object's name. Or if it's a number and whatever application you're working with doesn't know the difference between a text and number, then we include a parameter state, what data type is this thing that we're passing across. So there's lots of options in there as to how we deal with these elements and build out these processes.
Yeah. And I guess just to paraphrase, to cement that in my mind, is there like an Excel formula example? You see where I'm going with this? Like, instead of having a big old string that says, when this happens, do this, then do this, then do this, then do this, you're instead saying, step one, call this pre-built, object. Step two, call this. Do you see what I mean? And then, as you say, you've got the building blocks. Yeah, so you're not having to just reinvent every time and start from zero every time. Okay. You're saying, right, well, I've already done that before. So, like steps one and two might be different, but actually step three I can call from something that already exists.
Yes.
But the visualization in the presentation was pretty good. I don't know how okay you are with sharing the slides, that I can put them in the show notes.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know whether. Yeah, so I'll do that. I'll just put a Google Drive link in the show notes for everyone so they can have a look. But I think seeing it visually in that, because you had almost like a dashboard page in the worksheet, didn't you, that had all the buttons on the front of it that basically called those different functions. I think if we can share that, it helps cement a couple of things without me having to destroy it with my words. No, all good. So appreciate you coming on, Mark. Before we tell people where they can find more about you, obviously I'll put all the links in the show notes as well to your LinkedIn profile and that sort of stuff, I always ask my guests what piece of tech they can't live without. And this could be anything, right? And you can't say Excel or VBA or Power Query or anything like that. It could be an app on your phone. It could be a browser extension. It could be a gadget. We had Tamer at Calls also that his favorite gadget was his one blade razor. And I think I need to take a leaf out of his book because I'm looking a bit scruffy at the moment. But do you have like an app, gadget, or piece of software that you use in your personal professional life that you literally could not live without?
I mean, it depends how far you want to go with the words tech, right? Because back in the 1600s, this stuff was like, this was rock and roll, right? I mean, like a notebook and a pen, that was, if you could, that, as tech, you'd be like, well, there's no quill in that. That's no feather. This is a pure Bic. I think it's Bic. Who knows? So the ability, I mean, and I use that as a joke, but the ability to create notes somewhere is one of the most important things, because in today's distracted world, you need, even on weekends, right? If I get an idea somewhere, the first thing I do is email myself so that I don't have to then think about that anymore. So any application that helps you to keep track of your notes and to record things is critical. So you might say it's email, because Mark gets to email himself at the weekend whenever he thinks of something when he hasn't got a when he hasn't got his notebook next to him. But otherwise, you know, other people might use OneNote, but the most important is just to get ideas out of your head somewhere else, so that you can then get on with being present with the thing that you should be doing. Because unfortunately, the best time to think of good ideas is when you're not trying to think about them. So when you're playing with your kids, when you're at the park, when you're doing other stuff like that, that's the point at which the best ideas come. So the ability to send yourself a note or record a note somewhere is the most important thing. So, hey, if it's email to email myself, I'll say that. If it's writing it down on a bit of pen and, you know, pen and paper, I'll go with that. But that is the most important thing.
Whatever works for you, right? And I did a post, well, the newsletter last Friday was actually how to use AI to turn your voice into a productivity assistant, right? And it's the inspiration was given actually by I think Thomas Frank, who's one of the Notion experts. You heard of Notion? It's basically like a Microsoft OneNote. The guys at Notion have probably really told me off for drawing that comparison, but you hear what I'm saying. But the theory was I get grumpy in the winter, you know, so I need fresh air, and even if it's overcast, I need to go out and have a walk, you know, just to get out of the house and have a bit of a refresher. But as you say, when I'm walking, that's when the cogs start whirring, when I'm not looking at a screen. And I don't want to be typing on my phone, you know, when I'm walking, you know, but I'm quite happy to talk to myself because there's nobody around. I mean, there's like other side of the golf course, there's a massive wood, you know, so there's nobody about, you know, I could shout and nobody'd hear me, right? But I'll put my headphones in and I'll talk to myself, and then I'll just upload the transcript to whatever AI I'm playing with at the time, and then say, look, pull out the tasks from this, pull out the content ideas from this, and so on. It's quite handy. But for people that don't want to go full on talking to themselves, which I totally understand, not everybody's okay talking to themselves, even though we all talk to ourselves in our head, you can set up widgets on your phone that are literally like press button on phone and input note or voice note.
Yep.
So whether it's, I don't know whether OneNote's got a widget. I know Notion does, and there's a couple of others, but you could literally click plus on your home screen and just type in your note. You know, it's so easy to do now.
I mean, even this morning as I was walking the dog, so I had my phone in my pocket, had an idea, pulled out my phone, talked into my phone, and then sent myself an email of that note. It's only because email is my input place, right? I just want one place to receive all inputs. You know, the idea that you have to go to LinkedIn, you have to go to Facebook, you have to go to everywhere to get these inputs, they're making us work too hard. We just want one place where everything comes into. And for me, that place is my email. So I sent myself I've spoken my message that I wanted to send to myself, click send, and then you go on with your dog walk. However someone handles that, just being able to get it noted somewhere and then you can move on.
Yeah, whatever works for you. I mean, I've got, and I don't think they're contrarian views, but I don't really like email. Because I find it distracts me a lot. And if you can manage it, it's fine. But what I find when I go into email, and I do the same as you sometimes, if I don't have like my Notion up or whatever and I'm caught short, then I will email myself, especially if it's images, right? You know, if I take a picture and I need to send it, like I'll send myself the image, right? But I always find when I go into email, there's another email that pops up. And that immediately vies for my attention. And then I go off the task of sorting the productive stuff. And I find myself, without realizing it, responding to the email.
That's a huge risk. You have to be quite disciplined about the fact that, about when you decide to look at emails, when you don't. And or else otherwise, it's just on all day and the... Every email list you've ever signed up for is sending you emails, and that's a nice little distraction to make you not do some work. So, yeah, it's not, you know, and no one's going to send a message into your, you know, into your Notion account. So you're the only one that has access to that. So that is a fantastic solution. But email is a big trap. It can be, yeah.
Yeah, and if you can batch it, it's fine. You know, so I'm trying to get disciplined in saying, look, you know, email's a task, not an activity. So, you know, 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes lunch, 15 minutes in the afternoon. I try and do that where I can. It's not always easy. But there's some crazy stat that says the average knowledge worker checks their inbox like 36 times an hour. I mean, that's bonkers if you think in terms of not being able to get into that deep focus over the course of 90 minutes or whatever your time scale is. 36, but
they're checking their phones 36 times an hour as well. So, you know, that's... I mean, this is slightly off topic. The number of times I check my emails at the end of the day, right, I'm done, right? I get up from my desk, I pick up my phone, and the first thing I do is check my email. What's that about? I mean, it's like this pattern that we fall into. Oh, I pick up my phone, must check email. I've literally just checked it because, you know, we've programmed ourselves that whenever we look at our phone, I must check messages, picked up phone. So there's a whole load of human pattern behavior that we need to get out of.
Oh, I do exactly. I do it with LinkedIn as well. Like so again, I try and batch LinkedIn. So I schedule my posts so that they go out, you know, midday, 1 o'clock. And the trick there is obviously it hits the US when they're waking up and it hits, you know, Australia in the east when they're going to sleep. So living in GMT is actually quite an advantage, to be fair, because you get the full breadth of time zones there. And then I'll do my engagement, so my comments, you know, for 15 minutes or whatever, and then I'll try and shut it down. But then, of course, as soon as I get up from my desk, as you say, pick up my phone, oh, who's responded to my post from today? So I'll open LinkedIn on my phone. And I keep telling myself, and I'm going to make a note here right now, I used to use app blockers when I was going through full productivity ninja mode, you know. And I'd have an app blocker across all my devices, so obviously cloud application. So it'd end up in Google Chrome or Edge or whatever, be on your phone browser or whatever. And you set limits to say, do not let me open this URL or this app between these times. But I then find that I was going into the settings of the app blocker and turning off the settings so I could have a look. So, yeah, read into that what you like, but there's something wrong going on there. I think I don't know whether it's counselling or whatever, but, yeah, maybe that's too deep for today's conversation. But I've kept you too long, Mark. So where can people find out more about you and what you do?
So you can find me on, so excelofthegrid.com is my main home. That's where we have blog posts and pretty much everything that is important goes on there. Then we have, I'm reasonably active on LinkedIn. That's mainly just a place for me to connect with people, find out what's going on in the community. That's where I came across your stuff, Adam. So yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. So, I've got my middle name in my username, but it's Mark Stephen Proctor. If you want to find me, obviously, click on the face that looks like mine. That's the key to finding me on there. But yeah, LinkedIn or excelofthegrid.com. They're the two key places.
That's it. And if you're listening on audio, you're looking for blonde hair and glasses.
Yeah, yeah. If you are listening on audio, then he's the handsome one. Why are you laughing?
Perfect. And what I'll also do is I'll put the link to the post that I saw from you the other day, and I won't describe it because people can go and entertain their curiosity there. But it was on the theme of Excel is not a database.
Okay.
So I'll leave people with that. I'll put a link to the post that you did. It was a swipe file, and it was the story of somebody speaking to the IT team, trying to get them to sort a database for them, and the conversation that ensued. So yeah, click that link, read the post. It's hilarious.
It's just, you know, the people say Excel in a database. I know it's not a database. Then give me a database. But unfortunately, it's never that easy, is it? It's never that easy.
Never that easy. But yeah, check out the post. Okay, cool. Well, connect with Mark on LinkedIn. Check out Excel Off the Grid. But hopefully we'll catch up in due course. Mark, have you on again, maybe six months' time. See how you're getting on, if you're open to it.
Yeah,
it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Adam.
Hey again, and thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard today, don't forget to like, review, and subscribe. And for more goodies, head over to techforfinance.com. See you soon.